Show them what you're made of, Turner. I pep-talk myself, brushing a loose strand of hair back into my ponytail as I start down the steps toward the rink. Like the memory of 1,000 early morning practices, the sharp sound of blades cutting across the surface echoes through the arena, a symphony to any hockey lover's ears. I'm close enough to see the players' breaths hang in the air, their determined faces set and focused. Alexis Turner? A voice booms over the ambient noise. I turn to find the source, a man with a presence that fills the space around him. Coach Thompson stands there, barrel-chested, military-cut gray hair, khakis and long-sleeves polo impeccable, clipboard in hand, wearing a look that means business. Call me Lexi, I respond, extending my hand. My grip is firm, practiced. It has to be when you're stepping into a world dominated by men who could bench press your body weight. Right, Lexi. He clasps my hand with a nod, appraising me for a moment too long, slightly wary. Welcome aboard. Our physio, Drew, will typically be joining us when you're here, but today it's just us. Let's introduce you to the team. We weave between the benches and discarded water bottles until we're at the edge of the rink. The practice is now in full swing, players weaving intricate patterns on the ice, puck flying from stick to stick with a precision that speaks of endless drills. Everyone, Coach Thompson's voice cuts through the clatter. Practice slows as players circle around us, curiosity lighting up their sweat-glistened faces. This is Lexi, our new intern. She'll be assisting with physical therapies and ensuring you lot don't fall apart mid-season. I look over the team, noting each man as I recognize him. I've studied the roster and the team's online portfolios. Tyler Reed, defenseman. Chris Anderson, center. Dean the Machine Hartley. Kyle Flash Franklin. Alexander Xander Price. Reckless Reed Jackson. Wingers always have nicknames. And Eric Larson, goalie. A chorus of nods and murmurs greet me. None of them are too enthusiastic. And then, Noah Bishop, the captain, skates forward with an ease that speaks volumes of his time on the ice. His smile is genuine, welcoming. It makes something in my chest loosen. Nice to meet you, Lexi, he says, his voice calm and reassuring. Likewise, I reply. But before I can say more, another figure commands attention. Wes Jacobs, star forward, swishes closer with a swagger that takes up more space than it should. There's a challenge in his ice-blue eyes, visible even through his helmet, the kind that says he knows exactly how good he is. But underneath the bravado, I see something else, a flicker of something deeper. Suddenly, Lady the Bird flutters in the pouch and lets out three loud peeps. The sound twangs my heartstring, reminding me of what I know. I remember that look of tenderness on Ezzie's face when Lady hopped up to her. That's why she'll help. Come with me. I take a bold step around the signs and into the arc yard. I hold out my hand. You'll see. Char shakes her head. Her eyebrows drop low, and she clutches her lunchbox with both hands. I'll come. Ian bounds over to my side. I gotta go, says Char. She turns away, but then stops and says, I thought you trusted me. My mouth falls open, but no words come out. What is she talking about? Right now, she's the one who isn't trusting me. She doesn't trust that I know what I'm doing. She's being difficult, just when I need her. But I can't say any of that because she's already walking away, down the sun-dappled sidewalk. I feel a quick unspooling, like a kite flying away from me. I watch until she rounds the corner and out of sight, my hurt feelings bubbling up beside confused ones. A sharp thud sounds behind me, and I spin around to the front door, banging open. What in the world are you doing? Ezzie yells. Her eyes blaze and her nostrils flare. No tenderness here. She sweeps down the steps in a billowing silk robe and charges toward us, looking very much like a mad cow lady. Again, her feet are bare, and there's dirt between her toes. Just because I helped you once doesn't mean you can come around and prance all over my pennyroyal. I look down to where she's pointing, to the tiny green leaves that Ian and I have trampled. "Sorry," I stammer, hopping onto a stepping stone and yanking Ian onto another. "I thought it was some kind of grass." "Good gracious, there are more of you," Ezzie peers at Ian. "This is my brother," I say, "and we're sorry about your pennyroyal." "Hmm," says Ezzie. "Am I to expect your entire family to drop by?" "No," I say, and gather my courage. Ezzie isn't showing any signs of tenderness, but I have to believe it's here. "We have a question for you." "And I bet I'm not going to like it." "Well, you'd better come around back where you can trample all you like." We follow, careful to keep to the stepping stones. I erase from my mind the news article picture of Ezzie with the cows and the police. I replace it with a plan for how I'll know for sure if I can trust her. In 1882, Prince Albert Morrow, a New York City doctor whose practice specialized in sexually transmitted infections, STIs, published his English translation of a French book entitled Syphilis et Mariage, written by physician Jean-Alfred Fournier. In it, Fournier described the troubling phenomena he was witnessing as a doctor who treated STIs. His male patients were coming to him with complicated questions. If a man had had a past infection but hadn't been symptomatic in years, could he, in good conscience, now marry? Would future children be affected by present infections? Some of the questions medicine alone couldn't solve. If a patient contracted an infection outside of marriage, could he take steps to prevent its spread without his wife knowing? What information about his condition did the patient owe his wife? And what information, for that matter, did the doctor owe his patient's wife? These were complicated human and moral conundrums. Morrow was evidently quite moved by Fournier's writing, and in his translator's preface, he wrote, "There is scarcely a subject in the entire domain of medicine of greater practical importance to the profession and to the public." In 1899, 17 years after translating Syphilis and Marriage, Morrow paid his own way to attend the International Conference on Syphilis and Venereal Diseases in Brussels. There, medical experts from 29 countries convened to discuss the STIs ravaging their countries. Such infections, syphilis in particular, were running rampant globally. The British Army was admitting 122 of every 1,000 men to the hospital for an STI. In the Norwegian city of Christiania, now Oslo, 3,525 cases of gonorrhea and syphilis were recorded, affecting 1.56% of the population. The conference assumed that syphilis and other STIs were being spread primarily by sex work. As such, much of the work there was concerned with models of regulating, reducing, and abolishing the sex trades. There was little agreement among the delegates, however, when it came to functional resolutions. They did decide one thing, however, to create a permanent international society of sanitary and moral prophylaxis to be headquartered in Brussels. We can imagine Dr. Morrow listening as these experts reported on the rates of STIs in their countries, on their current mitigation efforts, and their future plans. Then, he returned to the United States, where there were no such data, no plans, and no measures in place to prevent infections. There was no way to know how the United States was faring in comparison to other countries. Was it possible that New York, Morrow's own city, was experiencing numbers as high as cities abroad?